This morning we're moving out of the book of Joy into sort of the Gospel of John, and we went from, you know, being content in all things and rejoicing in all things, and now we come to the final hours of Jesus' life. So it's sort of a pretty big shift of what's going to be taking place. But it's the final hours of Jesus' life on earth and the events that led up to this crucifixion. And he moves into these events with a calmness. Jesus is just sort of, okay, this is what's going to happen. This is how it's going to happen. And there's no anxiety. There's no tension. There's no fear. There's no worry. He moves in with a sense of a calmness and maybe even an anticipation, because the whole reason for his life was to accomplish that purpose, to die on the cross for us, to die for our sins, so that we could have forgiveness. That's why he has come, and that's why everything that is going to be taking place in the next couple of weeks as we go through this, he's going to be sharing. And Jesus is the prime mover in this. We sometimes focus on Pilate or Annas or Caiaphas, all of the other players, but it's Jesus that is the prime mover. Throughout his betrayal, throughout his arrest, throughout his trials, through his crucifixion, it's not Judas or anyone else, it's Jesus. Even though from the outside observer looking at it, it may look like all these people have power and authority over Jesus, but Jesus is just saying, okay, you're just fulfilling that which I have already planned. And it's Jesus who told Judas to do what he was to do. Okay, Judas, go do what you need to do. It was Jesus who went out with his disciples to a garden that he knew Judas knew where he was going to be. And it was he who went forward when the guards and everybody came to arrest him. And it was he that said to them, you know, let my disciples go and don't arrest them. And so you cannot read chapter 18 and 19 of John without noticing he leaves out many of the events. If you read that and you compare it to Luke and Matthew and Mark, there's a whole bunch of events that John leaves out. And he adds things that the other ones don't. Next week, Dawn will be preaching on all the things that John leaves out. She'll be talking more about the garden, about the cup of suffering, all of those things where John doesn't address that. Next week, Dawn will be here sharing on that. So as we look at chapter 18, we see three major events. The first is the story of the arrest at the Garden of Gethsemane. Here was Jesus' arrest. The second one is the trial. And then the third one is Peter's denial. So those are going to be the three sections from John chapter 1, chapter 18, verses 1 through 27. So the first is the story of the arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. After saying these things, Jesus crossed the Kidron Valley with his disciples and entered a grove of olive trees. This is verses 1 through 11. Judas, the betrayer, knew this place because Jesus had often gone there with his disciples. The leading priests and Pharisees had given Judas a contingent of Roman soldiers and temple guards to accompany him. Now, with blazing torches, lanterns, and weapons, they arrived at the olive grove. Jesus fully realized all that was going to happen to him, so he stepped forward to meet them. "Who are you looking for?" he asked. "Jesus the Nazarene," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. As Jesus said, "I am he," they all drew back and fell to the ground. Once more, he asked them, "Who are you looking for?" And again they replied, "Jesus the Nazarene." "I told you that I am he," Jesus said. "And since I am the one you want, let these others go." He did this to fulfill his own statement, "I did not lose a single one of those who you have given me." Then Simon Peter drew a sword and slashed off the right ear of Malchus, the high priest's slave. But Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword back into its sheath. Shall I not drink from the cup of suffering the Father has given me?" Again, the most striking feature of John's account of this event is what John does not record. He doesn't record any of the events that take place in the garden. Each of the other three Gospels will relate this incident when Jesus took Peter, James, and John and asked them to pray with him. Then retiring further into the garden, he knelt and cried out to his Father, asking that if possible, if this cup could pass me by, let it pass by. But John says nothing of the loud cries, the tears, the bloody sweat that fell from his brow, his threefold prayer, his strengthening by the angel who appeared to him at the end of this ordeal. None of that. What John actually records is the picture of Jesus after all of that, coming out of the garden with purpose and resolve, in full command of what is happening, ready to fulfill his destiny. I've been through the garden. I've done all that. Now this is what I came to do. And in verse 3, the leading priests and Pharisees had given Judas a contingent, a cohort. 600 men are with Judas to arrest Jesus alone. Now with blazing torches, lanterns, and weapons, they arrived at the olive grove. I just find it interesting how so much that takes place in the night, under the sort of the disguise of secrecy, and then in the light of the day, how all of this gets brought to, you know, to a whole new perspective. Jesus fully realized all that was going to happen to him, so he stepped forward to meet them. "Who are you looking for?" he asked. "Jesus the Nazarene," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. Judas was standing with them. As Jesus said, "I am he," they all drew back and fell to the ground. John says that Jesus met the crowd of soldiers and Pharisees who were coming to arrest him and immediately identified himself. He wasn't trying to hide. He wasn't trying to escape. He was just confronting them who were confronting him and saying, "This is why I came. So I'm the one you're looking for." All at this, the soldiers drew back and fell to the ground. Now, this could have meant any couple of things. One, it could have been an anticipated counterassault as soon as Jesus came forth, and so the soldiers sort of got back in a defensive position, waiting for some kind of attack from the 12. And, you know, or what I believe is that as soon as he said that, "I am he," that was such a powerful statement about God that they could have just fallen back. Also, these soldiers have been around. They've been hearing about all the stories about Jesus, all the healings, all the things that he has done, that he's claimed to be the Son of God. And now they are commanded to go and arrest this person after all the miracles, everything that he has done. And so I'm wondering if just from the perspective of what he said, "I am he," they fell in wonder and awe at who they were actually arresting. And then he asks for the release of his disciples. And I just find that so interesting. In the midst of being arrested, in the midst of facing his crucifixion, in the midst of facing trials that were just a mockery, and knowing that all that he was going to participate in, what is he concerned about? "My followers. You got me. Let my people go. Let my followers go." And he does the same thing for us. Sometimes we think that Jesus just doesn't hear, that he's not concerned, but we are always first and foremost on his mind. That's why he came, and after he was confronted, he said, "You know, let my disciples go." Now, Peter, of course, could not leave. And you get the impression that all the rest said, "Okay, we're out of here. You know, this is more than I bargained for." And they all left except Peter and one other disciple, from what it looks like. And Peter couldn't leave because he was still living on the emotional high and the self-confident promise he had made that he would defend Jesus to the death and that he would never deny him. You can find that in Luke, When that's the story there. So he drew off his sword and cut off Malchus's ear. And Malchus was a representative of the high priest and therefore represented the high priest authority. And cutting off an ear or a nose was considered particularly humiliating, especially since Jews were not allowed to go into the temple or worship in the temple if there was some defect, some disfigurement in their body, so they couldn't serve him. And so immediately, by cutting off his ear, he disqualified the servant, Malchus. And again, what Peter does is this act of reaction. And if you take a look at Peter on the net, well, I'll get to that later. Anyway, it was an act of reaction. Peter, once again, had to be corrected. But this time in front of his enemies, not just the disciples. Jesus corrected Peter for behaving like a non-believer. You've been with me. We just had a meal together. I just washed your feet. I just told you everything that was going to take place. And now you're believing like somebody who had never knew me. You're taking things into your own hands and trying to figure it out on your own. You don't see the plan of God unfolding despite all the predictions that Jesus had given him, and some just a few short hours ago. And then in verses 12 through 14, so the soldiers, the commanding officers, and the temple guards arrested Jesus and tied him up. First they took him to Anna's house, since he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest at that time. Caiaphas was the one who had told the other Jewish leaders, it's better that one man should die for the people. So this has all been set. The stage has been set. And injustice in all of this, because the whole scene is a scene of injustice, is an inevitable fact of a fallen world. Sooner or later, everyone will be misunderstood. Sooner or later, everyone will be misquoted. Sooner or later, everyone's going to be falsely accused, slandered, gossiped about, or openly maligned. If none of that has ever happened to you, you live in a far better mental state than I do. You know, there's just a sense where it just is a part of a fallen world. Because we bear the image of God, who loves justice as much as he loves mercy, we too hunger for justice and mercy. The problem lies in the fact that we love mercy more than justice when it comes to ourselves, and love justice more than mercy when it comes to the person sitting next to us. And maybe not the person sitting next to the person out there. Jesus was the only person to live his entire life without failing morally. Yet he was arrested and tried, convicted and condemned to suffer a criminal's punishment. His arrest was a betrayal. The trials were a farce. His convictions illegal, and his sentence a travesty of justice. Yet throughout the ordeal, throughout all of that, he remained calm. He answered questions directly. He spoke the truth, and he resolved to allow the Father to vindicate him at the proper time. I only wish I had that same resolve, that whenever I have felt that life has been treating me unfairly, that I could stay calm. That I could just say, you know what? It's not my issue. God's got this. He's got this. My wife has a shirt that says, it's not my circus, not my monkeys. I told she had to add a line, but I know all the clowns. But sometimes we act like everything that's going around is our circus, and it is our monkeys, and we have to control everything that there is instead of just saying, okay, God, this is in your hands. Nothing here is surprising you. Nothing that is going on is a surprise. So I'm just going to surrender and trust you through it all. Now Jesus is brought to Annas, a powerful ecclesiastical politician who had been the high priest, but he no longer was the high priest, but he was a kingmaker. Five of his sons had been high priest after him. And so he's sort of the, you know, the key politician in Chicago who's running the show. And everybody else looks like they're running the show. But if you really want anything done, you go to, you know, the kingmaker. And so they take him to him. And now you have the second event that John summarized, the trials before the Jewish priests. Simon Peter followed Jesus, as did another of the disciples. That other disciple was acquainted with the high priest, so he was allowed to enter the high priest's courtyard with Jesus. Peter had to stay outside the gate. Then the disciple who knew the high priest spoke to the woman watching at the gate, and she let Peter in. The woman asked Peter, You're not one of that man's disciples, are you? And he said, no, I am not. Because it was cold, the household servants and the guards had made a charcoal fire. They stood around it, warming themselves, and Peter stood with them, warming himself. So Peter was in the presence of Jesus at the Last Supper, and now he's standing in the council of the wicked in just a few short hours. The striking thing about this account is that when the other disciples came out and asked the maid to let Peter in, she asked him, are you the man's disciples? He had no reason at that point to deny that. He was in no danger. The other person with Peter was also a disciple, and he was there and he was let in. They weren't going to do, nothing was a problem at this point. Throughout this whole account, he had not been harassed. But fear took over, and Peter foolishly determined to do it his way. And that's what got him into trouble. Instead of trusting Jesus at this point, I'll go ahead and do it my own way. He believed like the little boy who said about a lie. A lie is a sin, but a very present help in time of trouble. And many live with that philosophy. Instead of just surrendering and trusting it to Christ, we say, what do I need to do to take care of this myself? How do I have to figure this out? And then we have verses 19 through 24. Inside, the high priest began asking Jesus about his followers and what he had been teaching them. Jesus replied, everyone knows what I teach. I have preached regularly in the synagogues and the temple where the people gather. I have not spoken in secret. Why are you asking me this question? Ask those who heard me. They know what I said. Then one of the temple guards standing nearby slapped Jesus across the face. Is that the way to answer the high priest? He demanded. Jesus replied, if I said anything wrong, you must prove it. But if I'm speaking the truth, why are you beating me? Then Annas bound Jesus and sent him to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now, the whole trial, everything that's going on here, is against Jewish law. So everything is illegal. Annas was not really the high priest, but the father-in-law of the high priest. He was the power behind the throne. Annas begins this interrogation on a totally illegal basis. No trial was to be held in secret at nighttime. That's one. Two, he's not the high priest. And the only proper place to hear criminal cases was the Hall of Judgment in the temple. Annas also broke Sanhedrin rules by asking Jesus directly about his followers and his teachings, hoping to hear something incriminating. Jesus' response appears to be insolent. However, he was merely pointing out the proper procedure. So he said in verse 21, he says, why are you asking me these questions? He's just pointing out that you have no right by your own law to ask me these questions. So what seems insolent is not at all. In a present-day American courtroom, counsel for the defense might have said, objection. Objection. According to Mishnah, Nezikin 3, chapter 3, points 3 and 4, the accused may not be compelled to present evidence against himself. Jewish law can't present evidence against yourself. Furthermore, the presiding judge may not examine a witness. And so here's Annas doing all the, you know, the judging and asking all the questions against the law. In response, Jesus declares that none of his teachings has been secret or hidden. I spoke openly. I always taught in the synagogues. In secret, I have said nothing. Those who heard him could testify that he shared the truth openly. So in this bold challenge to the high priest, he is completely within his rights. Again, cruelty and violence were never allowed in the courtroom. Never allowed in the courtroom. Yet one of the guards walks up to Jesus and slaps him across the face. So every event that took place that night broke the Jewish law that they were so concerned about. Through all of this, Jesus never wavered from his purpose. Never wavered from his purpose. Instead, he maintained perfect composure and responded with a perfectly reasonable request. If I have done something wrong, tell me what it is. If not, why do you hit me? That is against the law. So, he said in effect, if my objection should be overruled, state the legal precedent. If it should be sustained, I should not be punished for being right. And that's exactly what was happening. Jesus was being punished for being right. Now, I don't know if you've ever faced a situation where you knew you were right, but you were still being punished. And you've had these unfair treatments of life, what you believe are injustices. You know, probably most of us have had some kind of an experience with that. And yet, here's Jesus saying, that's okay. Notice the contrast between Jesus and Peter on this night. When Peter was asked a fair and simple question, one that did not jeopardize him in the least, yet he answered with a lie and pretense. But when Jesus was asked devious and illegal questions, he replied openly and honestly, only to be met with contempt and a slap on the face. So, truth caused Jesus pain. The lie kept Peter safe for a moment. Which leads to the third event that John points out in this chapter, Peter's denial. Meanwhile, as Simon Peter was standing by the fire warming himself, they asked him again, "You're not one of the disciples, are you?" He denied it, saying, "No, I am not." But one of the household slaves of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Didn't I see you out there in the olive grove with Jesus?" "Eh, possibly, I just cut off your uncle's ear." Again, Peter denied it. And immediately, a rooster crowed. Unlike Matthew and Mark, John does not include the details of the Lord's trial before Caiaphas, who officially held the position of high priest. Unfortunately, justice didn't fare any better at this trial than at the last. While the hearing appeared more legitimate, conducted by the actual high priest and attended by several members of the Sanhedrin, it violated many of the same rules. So once again, it's a mock trial with a conclusion already planned, and we're just going to go through the motion so that we can legally condemn Jesus. Meanwhile, out in the courtyard, Peter is unwillingly fulfilling Jesus' prophecy, and two more denials completed his failure. And all of this started just a few short hours before because of Peter's self-confidence. Because Jesus had, at the table, said to Peter, "Peter, you're going to deny me three times tonight. And after you do that and you come back to faith, you will be able to strengthen your brothers. I'm going to pray for you." And Peter's response was, "Don't worry, Jesus, I don't need your prayers." Don't worry, Jesus, I will never deny you. Don't worry, Jesus, I got this. I'm your man. I'm your Huckleberry. I'll be there no matter what you go through. And at that point, all his self-confidence was there. It was all Peter's strength to do whatever he wanted to do on his own. And that self-confidence led to a lack of devotion, because he takes him to the garden and he says, pray, and he doesn't. He falls asleep. And that lack of devotion led to an act of reaction. So there's Peter, and instead of doing, you know, listening to Jesus, he just, in fact, he asked Jesus, says, what should we do? And before Jesus could even respond, he cuts off an ear. And so this is sort of an act of reaction. And I wonder how many times in our lives do we make a decision started on self-confidence, I can do this, and then it led to a lack of devotion. I don't even need to pray about it. And then it led to an act of reaction. Instead of saying, no, I need to slow down and trust God in this situation. Because after that lack of reaction, he started following Jesus from afar. The other disciples had left, but he and one other disciple started following Jesus to see where they were going to take him. So he's following from afar. And then finally, he's sitting in the courtyard with the other disciples. Not the other disciples, but the enemies of Jesus. So now he's sitting in the council of the wicked. And you can read Psalm 1. It just warns about sitting in the council of the wicked. And then from there, he denies Jesus. So you just see this downward progression that all began with a pride that says, I can do this on my own. I don't need God. And sometimes we might be guilty of doing those same types of things. Anyway, so he denies Jesus. The minute he did, there came the sound of a rooster crowing. And Peter remembered what Jesus had said. And according to the other accounts, at that very moment, Jesus walked across the courtyard and caught his eye. Now, I know a lot of you don't watch The Chosen. That's the scene I want to see, where Jesus denies him for the third time, and then those eyes connect. And he sees the eyes of a loving Savior who doesn't show condemnation, doesn't show anger, doesn't show anything but love and grace and forgiveness, because this was all part of his plan. And the whole reason Jesus came was to reconcile us to him, regardless of our mistakes, regardless of our shortcomings, regardless where we've been. He always wants to take us to the next place forward with him. When Peter saw those eyes filled with mercy and tender love, he broke down and wept. Quickly leaving the area, he went out and wept bitterly in the streets of Jerusalem. John now turns to the account of Jesus before Pilate. As the first two trials of Jesus came to a close, we see that he would respond to the injustice to the next four. The same way that he responded to the first two, he's going to respond to the next ones. The Lord knew that he would not receive justice from men. He knew that the world was, then as now, polluted with sin and ruled by corrupt people, because if Satan is the prince of this earth, what else are you going to have? So why would people expect anything to be different? So he did not expect justice from the courts, nor did he seek the approval of people. Instead, Jesus submitted to the will of the Father, who permitted injustice to advance his plan. This is the way, the only way my plan is going to be fulfilled is by the injustice of this world. And throughout his ordeal, he trusted the one who would ultimately and inevitably judge every soul righteously. He trusted his Father. I can think of few situations more personally challenging than during the unfair treatments of life, the injustices, and to face those things alone and unnoticed. When we feel isolated and alone, we long for an advocate, while an uncaring world idly watches our suffering. When we experience the reality of an unfair world, the silence of heaven can be deafening. We just want to hear something. We want some form of an advocate that says, it's okay, I'm here, I've got it. And let me assure you that the Lord does hear our cries. He hears our cries for help. He hears our cries for hope. And he does not ignore them. Justice will be served, although not necessarily according to our plan or on our time frame. Therefore, he does not prevent us from experiencing injustices. He doesn't prevent us from escaping trials, from being set free from grief or loss or any of those things. But he has promised to keep us and strengthen us through those injustices, through those unfair treatments of life. Moreover, he promised glory on the other side of our sufferings. And he said, you know, all things work to the good to those who love God and are according to his plan. All things to those who love God and focus on that instead of focusing on the world. The times in our lives when our trials or our suffering feels overwhelming will not go to waste. If you will allow it, the experiences can be means by which God brings you his greatest blessings. Those aren't the best words to end a sermon with. Your trials, your hurts, your pains, the injustices, the unfair treatment of life, if you allow it, it can bring you the greatest blessings. That's not usually what you hear on TV. You know, it's not that you have to go through that to get the blessing. The blessing is already yours. All you have to do is claim it, is what you hear on TV. They don't give you the side story, the back story. No, it takes work. It takes pain. It takes struggle sometimes to experience the full blessings that God wants us to have.